Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Matters, a show in which I discuss all matters of the mind, in which I show how much mind matters. Welcome to part 36 of Control Your Brain, Control Your Life. I am Udo Staatsbuchler and I'm live on air. You can call in at any time with questions and comments on the subject I'm talking about. If you have any questions, comments and suggestions not related to the subject matter, please go to my website http://www.mindmattersonline.info. Mind Matters Online is one word. There you will find my email address and then just write to me. I will reply within 48 hours. The same, of course, applies also if you cannot get through with your calls to this show. On my website, you will find also the last 20 or so recordings of my show and a link that directs you to the Blog Talk Radio archive in which you will find all my shows, old and new. Last week, I started on health, thought, and mind, and I explained psychosomatic disorders and illnesses, and also mentioned the obvious, namely that body and mind are totally intertwined, and whatever affects the body affects also the mind, and whatever affects the mind affects also the physical body. In this show, I will talk about how we can use this knowledge in order to fight severe illnesses, to get well quicker, or to stay healthy. Although I'm going to mention cancer more often than any other life-threatening illness, this does not mean that whatever I say is only applicable to cancer. It is applicable to any disease. The only reason why I use cancer as an example is that I had cancer some years ago and have it again. And I fight it. Moreover, as a psychotherapist, I have worked with a good number of cancer patients. So, I have been through the mill, and I know what I'm talking about. Let me begin with quotes from exceptional cancer patients I knew and worked with. Here's the first, and he said, "I kept going back and forth and back again, trying to see objectively and asking myself, why me? Why should this happen to me? Until I was exhausted. Even then I couldn't let go. I looked at the way the doctor said things would probably go, and then I looked at the things I wanted for myself and my family, all the things they told me would probably not be possible. Then I thought to myself, before diagnosis, I did not know for sure how long I was going to live, but I went ahead with living anyway. So, now what you have to do is the same thing, only better, in case you have to get more done in less time than you thought you had. Suddenly I could see what was worth going after and what was not, and I did only do what felt right. And basically, that's where things are now. Here's the next. I have cancer days and I have non-cancer days. On the non-cancer days, I carry on the way I always did. It never occurs to me that I have this illness. I'm doing everything I can to make more days non-cancer days." Another one said, "The other day, I had a lot of pain in my back, so I called the hospital. The nurse I spoke to said, maybe it means that the treatment is working and that's the inflammation from your immune response. I thought that this was wonderful, and a little while later the pain faded away. And lastly, before the diagnosis, I never seemed to have the time to do all the things I did not want to do anyway. Now, just when I'm told that I could have very little time left, I seem to have so much more time when I do what I really want to do. Play with my grandchildren, take long walks along the beach by myself, sit in the sun with my dog. Often I do nothing at all except look around me and enjoy being just exactly where I am right now. It all seems like a gift. I'm so surprised I never saw it before. In a strange way, I feel better now than I ever did when I was officially well. These four quotes are fine examples of people who all had accepted that they had cancer. What they also had in common, other than having cancer, was their attitude. They all accepted the fact, and they all made the best of what they had. None of them panicked, none of them despaired. I have identified these people, and a few more, as exceptional patients because of their behaviors and their beliefs. Behavior and belief can be replicated by others, and can produce the same results. And this is the purpose of what I will be talking about. Let me give you a few key points. First, there is no such thing as false hope. Hope gives you strength, gives you optimism, makes you look forward with positive expectancy. It makes you feel good. Feeling good decreases stress and boosts your immune system. Second, human beings function as a system comprising physical, mental, spiritual, social, and behavioral components. A system is an organized set of components that is conveniently regarded as a whole. Living organisms seek constantly to reestablish homeostatic balance when any element of the system is disturbed. This is part of the self-healing ability of our body, of our system. Third, you impact your own health by many ways, including the way you communicate with yourself. Good internal and external communication is essential. It is probably one of the most important things an ill person can do to facilitate and accelerate the healing process. I will come back to this quite often in this short health series. Fourth, there is also something that I call acquired helplessness. This is an extremely significant factor in both physical and mental health. Acquired helplessness is mainly the product of certain, usually unconscious, life decisions, beliefs, and internal strategies. In many cases, drugs will be largely ineffective and could even contribute to an exacerbation of symptoms and the underlying disease. Unfortunately, acquired helplessness is actively installed and maintained by the prevailing paradigm of medicine, which has assumed the right to decide what individuals do with their bodies and minds, what will be useful for them in their own recovery, and even whether or not they have any personal power at all to influence the progress of their illness. The opposite of acquired helplessness is healthy proactivity, and one can find the difference between them in the coping strategies. For example, in acquired helplessness, the ill person has no perception of control. In healthy proactivity, he assumes control. In acquired helplessness, he or she has no task involvement, whereas on the opposite side, he or she is indeed actively involved, very much so. The helpless person has little or no positive structure in their life. A healthily proactive person has a positive lifestyle concerning diet, stress and toxin reduction, physical and emotional fitness, relaxation, and so on. An ill person who has acquired helplessness will withdraw from social interaction. A proactive person will seek or maintain social networks. It is almost needless to say that the helpless person is often in a very depressed mood, whereas the proactive one always strives for a sense of well-being. I would say that a person with acquired helplessness is what I call a typical patient. A typical patient, in my mind, more often than not, will also ignore or even reject hope for fear that this could lead to disappointment. And as far as communication is concerned, a typical patient is a person who cries and moans over their illness, complains bitterly, and sees everything as hopeless and useless. Other than that, my interpretation of a typical patient is an individual who takes his or her illness to the doctors and says, "Here's my problem, you deal with it, it's yours now." And then thinks that from now on, everything will go according to the doctor's plan. This may be so in the case of an ingrown toenail or even in mild illnesses. But I'm talking here about serious and life-threatening diseases. These illnesses need more than just a medical doctor. They need your, the ill person's, active involvement in coping with the illness or managing it, and most importantly, in the healing process. And this active involvement, I do not mean just swallowing the pills the doctor prescribes, or sticking to a particular diet, or whatever other treatment plan. I mean much, much more than that. Your active participation should be the core of the treatment, your self-treatment, and the medical and medicinal input is there to support what you are doing. Our mind is the most powerful tool that we have for health and healing. Of course, it can, and very often is, also the limiter of health and healing as well. We have known for a long time that most illnesses are caused or exacerbated by stress and mind. This includes cancer, heart disease, diabetes, back problems, and many, many more. Since most of our stress is caused by our mind, think about your worries, think about feeling overworked, it stands to reason that this is also the mind where your greatest power lies to eliminate or greatly reduce stress. And it is the power of our mind that can greatly enhance our energy, boost our immunity, increase our resistance to many diseases, and also increase the likelihood of our longevity. A well-known example of mind over matter is placebo. For years, scientists have looked at the placebo effect as just a figment of overactive patients' imaginations. Sure, dummy medications seem to curb epileptic seizures, lower blood pressure, soothe migraines, and smooth out jerky movements in Parkinson's. But these people were not really better. Or so the scientists thought. Now, using PET scanners and MRIs to peer into the heads of patients who respond to sugar pills, researchers have discovered that the placebo effect is not all in the patient's head, but rather in their brains. New research shows that the belief in a dummy treatment leads to changes in brain chemistry. This research shows that thoughts do actually interact with the brain in a physical way. New insights into how placebo work may even help scientists figure out how to harness the effect and teach people to train their own brains to help with healing. Recent reports show that anticipation of relief from a placebo can lead to an actual easing of aches when the brain makes more of its own pain-relieving opiates. Brain scans of Parkinson's patients show increases in a chemical messenger called dopamine, which leads to an improvement in symptoms when the patient thinks, mistakenly, on that more are helped by placebo treatments as by actual medications. Researchers are just starting to appreciate the power that the mind can have over the body. An emerging idea right now is that belief in placebo taps into processes in your mind that produce physical results that really shape how your body responds to things. The brain has much more control over the body than we can voluntarily exert. A Stanford University scientist figured there must be a way to harness the placebo response to help patients soothe their own pain. The researcher rigged up an MRI so that people could watch real-time images of their brains while lying in the scanner. The idea was to use the images to teach study volunteers to consciously pump up activity in those parts of the brain that are activated by the placebo effect. One of those volunteers signed up for the study in hopes that she might be able to find a way to quiet the constant permanent pain that descended after her right shoulder and arm were smashed in a riding accident 8 years earlier. As we know, pain is not in the muscle or the arm that may be injured, but the pain is in our brains. A signal starts out at an injured site and travels up to the brain. But until the brain interprets that electrical signal, you don't actually feel the pain. Part of what goes into the brain's interpretation is expectation. I think of the placebo response, at least in part, as a manipulation of expectancy. And perhaps by changing the expectancy and bumping up the placebo response, science might be able to ultimately find a way to provide sustained therapy for chronic pain. Lying back in the scanner and watching images of her brain, the research volunteer with the injured shoulder and arm was told to conjure up memories of her pain on the day of the accident. Later, she was instructed to think soothing thoughts. She imagined little people scooping away the pain, trying to rescue her. And she thought about water or snowflakes putting the fire out. Through trial and error, she determined which kinds of thoughts fired up and which turned down those brain regions that were linked to her pain. And the mental pictures had an impact. In the scan, she could watch her brain producing pain. And then she saw how she gained control over the levels of pain and experienced how she could turn up the level of pain and how she could turn it down to zero. But for somebody in the grasp of pain and being what I described as a typical patient, it would be very difficult to even contemplate the possibility of feeling well and thus conjuring up moments of being free of pain. To do this, one needs to overcome the limitations a typical patient has and to become at least a bit optimistic. And, believe it or not, being an optimist is already the first step to becoming capable of managing or curing your illness or disease. Research has shown that optimists recover better from medical procedures such as coronary bypass surgery, have healthier immune systems, and live longer, both in a general and when suffering from conditions such as cancer, heart disease, and kidney failure. It is well accepted that negative thoughts and anxiety can make us ill. Stress, for example, the belief that we are at risk, triggers physiological pathways such as a flight or fight response mediated by the sympathetic nervous system. These have evolved to protect us from danger. But if switched on long term, they increase the risk of illness. What researchers are now realizing is that positive beliefs don't just work by quelling stress. They have another positive effect too: feeling safe and secure, or believing things will turn out fine, seems to help the body maintain and repair itself. A recent analysis of various studies concluded that the health benefits of such positive thinking compared to the harm caused by negative states, such as pessimism or stress, are roughly comparable in magnitude. Optimism seems to reduce stress-induced inflammation and levels of stress hormones such as cortisol. It may also reduce susceptibility to disease by dampening sympathetic nervous system activity and stimulating the parasympathetic nervous system. The latter, the parasympathetic nervous system, governs the so-called rest and digest response, the opposite of fight or flight, which, as I said, is governed by the sympathetic nervous system. Just as helpful as taking a rosy view of the future is having a rosy view of yourself. Hi, what I call self-enhancers, people who see themselves in a more positive light than some others see them, have lower cardiovascular responses to stress and recover faster, as well as lower baseline cortisol levels. Some people are just born optimists. But whatever your natural disposition, you can train yourself to think more positively, and it seems that the more stressed or pessimistic you are to begin with, the better it will work. Let me tell you now of one tool that I use daily to combat cancer, and that is meditation. Meditation is probably one of the most effective natural techniques that anyone can do to quickly and effectively increase their well-being, health, and immunity, and help themselves feel so much better, especially on an emotional level. Unfortunately, it's also one of the most confusing things to most people, and one that most find is very difficult to begin to do. When most people think of the idea that they have to learn to calm down their minds or gain control over it, there's a bit of fear and a big collective sigh at that thought of trying to do this. Why is it that the mind is so hard to control and to calm down? Well, mostly because thoughts occur on many levels, and in fact, the more you try to stop thought, the more the mind tends to fight and throws even more thoughts in your way. The mind just runs wild, and it must be taught to stay in its place. This can take quite a long time to really master it, but it comes in stages, and once you do master it, the benefits are tremendously worth it. Many people find this very frustrating and soon give up, and simply and wrongly conclude that meditation is just not for me. Well, that's not true at all. Anyone can learn to meditate and gain the great health and emotional benefits of this incredibly effective and time-honored technique. Learning to calm down the mind and gain control over it is a veritable tool in the fight for health. That's because if the mind is constantly thinking for no real reason, energy is being dispersed, and just like an idling car engine wastes its fuel, you are wasting your energy and going nowhere, generating a lot of heat that is just being vented out into the atmosphere and the universe and getting nothing back. It dissipates into the air and can never again be recovered, at least not in the same form, and not with existing technologies. When the mind is calm, energy does not vanish. It stays at its residence or source, meaning it will stay within the body to be used and not wasted by being dispersed into the atmosphere or turned into useless heat, that is stress in the body. Meditation helps us to sustain energy by calming down our thoughts, which helps us to attain a more peaceful state and prevent us from wasting energy with the constant and mostly useless chatter that we get from the subconscious mind. It is this type of constant thought that leads to unnecessary and detrimental stress. The more our mind is racing, the more it invents and creates things to worry about. So, how do we begin to learn to calm down the mind? The first step is to gain control over the mind itself. There are many techniques that have been discovered and developed for this over the millennia. I can tell you only about the method that I use, and I begin by simply paying attention to my breathing. Our mind and energy follows our breathing. When we are angry, our exhalations are longer than our inhalations. When we are sad, our inhalations are longer than our exhalations. When we are calm and neutral of thought, then our inhalations and exhalations are equal in length. In paying attention to your breathing, simply start by being aware of each breath and start to slow down your breathing. Try this for at least 5 minutes, as this is also an excellent warm-up to use before beginning any meditation session as well. As you breathe in and out, use your conscious will and mind to begin to command your mind to calm down. Do this gently, otherwise the mind will only become more tense, the opposite of what we are trying to accomplish. As we begin to calm down our minds, we will also feel calmer and more balanced. When this happens, the function and strength of our organs is automatically enhanced and increased, sometimes significantly so. And this is how having a calm mind can and does greatly improve our health. After your mind is calm, a simple method of meditation that I prefer people start off with is to practice simple concentration exercises. This is because if you cannot concentrate, you will not have any control over your mind, and you will not be able to will the mind to calm down effectively. The concentration exercises themselves are a type of meditation. So you kill two birds with one proverbial stone this way. One of the simplest and most effective methods is to simply practice by staring at a lit candle for about 5 minutes at a time without being distracted by stray thoughts. You'll find that you can do this for maybe 10 or maybe even 20 seconds at a time, but then all of a sudden you'll start thinking about various worries about tomorrow, what happened yesterday, what to make for dinner, the show you saw last night. And then you realize, whoops, what happened? Then you'll understand this is actually quite hard to do. But continue practicing it and you will get better and better at it. Once you are able to concentrate for about 5 minutes this way, then focusing your mind internally on quieting your mind will be more successful, since your mind will now be much stronger overall. A good exercise to concentrate on the flame is to try to mentally bend the flame in different directions, sometimes towards you, sometimes away from you, to the left or right, while staring at it. It will not really move by your mind, though, even though normal air currents will make it move on its own. But the conscious act of trying to move it gives the mind something else to concentrate on, and it also increases your strength of will. After you have achieved the 5 minutes of concentration requirements, you will find already that your mind is calmer, more focused, and perhaps that you even have more energy overall. Of course, this is something that you need to practice every day. Depending on how serious you are about it and your commitment to it, you will find this goal can be achieved in a relatively short time, from a few weeks, say 2 or 3 weeks, to perhaps, well, a few months. Like anything, it takes commitment and a never give up attitude. In our culture, where everyone is looking for a quick fix, this may sound like a long time, but it's really not. At first, the desire to quit is strong, but just stick with it and do it seriously and believe in the training and the goal, and this belief itself will greatly help you to achieve this or any goal much faster than if your mind is filled with doubt about it. Meditation increases also our sense of mind-body connection, and the greater this connection is and the calmness of mind we have, the greater is our health, our immunity, and our overall sense of well-being. Not to mention the greater emotional health and the elevated mood we will have on a more consistent basis. When we feel better about ourselves, all of the little things in life that so many people are getting so flustered over really become almost nothing. Because that is the way to overcome any obstacle. If you shrink the size of a problem down in your mind to nothing and believe that it truly is nothing, then you can easily convince yourself that you can overcome it. This is a simple way to increase your faith in yourself, in your own skills, and in your ability to solve a problem. We know that we can change negative responses by reframing and meaning-making, and I spoke about it at length before. It is important to know that reframing is actually quite easy once you know when and how to apply it. However, it happens that people who are not used to it do not use it if and when it is required. They may be overwhelmed by the task at hand or by the event they are affected by, and then they just react in the old and perhaps negative way. That is why the practice of reframing is so important. Practice it daily, even when you do not really need it. It's just like learning to lift a heavy weight. You didn't start out with a heavy weight, but a lighter weight. Over time and practice, as you get stronger, you eventually found that you could lift that heavy weight. The mind works in a very similar way. The more you work it, the stronger it will become. Just as it takes time and practice to lift a heavy weight, so too does it take time and practice to overcome the heavier or larger problems on the mind. We can all have a tendency to make a problem larger than it really is. While we can all do this at times, we don't want to make problems larger, but smaller. We want to use our minds to see the truth that the problem is only as large as we make it in our minds, and only as large as the belief is in our ability to overcome it. Meditation and visualizations go very well together. A picture is worth a thousand words. We have heard that saying before. This phrase is certainly true in the case of visualization. Visualization, a form of self-hypnosis in a way, is a tool anyone can use to help fostering healing. By providing positive pictures, creative imagery, and self-suggestions, visualization can change emotions that subsequently have a physical positive effect on the body. Our belief system is based upon the accumulation of verbal and non-verbal suggestions that we have gathered throughout our life experience. Through patterns of repetition and its associated rewards and punishment, we create our own perception of reality. In essence, we therefore become what we think. In healing, repetitive use of positive visualization allows access to the mind-body connection. This lets the mind and body work together to foster the healing process of the body on a physical level. What is the mind-body connection and how does it work? Well, when we have an emotion that it generates a feeling that turns into a physical sensation. For example, you are watching a horror movie. You feel frightened and then get a chill up your spine. In this case, you were getting a negative suggestion through your sensory perceptions, the sight and sound of the movie, that produced an emotion of fear, which turned into the physical sensation of chills up your spine. Visualizations use positive images to produce positive emotions that manifest into positive physical sensations in the body. Sounds simple, but does it work? Can what we think actually have an effect on healing? Bodies do react to the thoughts you make. Our psychological emotional state affects the endocrine system. For example, the emotion of fear is related to adrenaline. If no feeling of fear exists, there is no adrenaline. And the same applies in reverse. No adrenaline, no fear. They work in relationship to each other. Wherever a thought goes, there is a body chemical reaction. The hypothalamus, the emotional center of the brain, transforms emotions into physical response. The receptor of neuropeptides, the hypothalamus also controls the body's appetite, blood sugar levels, body temperature, adrenal and pituitary glands, heart, lung, digestive, and circulatory systems. Neuropeptides, the chemical messenger hormones, carry emotions back and forth between the mind and body. They link perceptions of the brain to the body via organs or hormones and cellular activity. Neuropeptides influence every major section of the immune system. So the body and mind do work together as one unit. The brain is a highly efficient system that is connected to every cell in your body by billions of connections. It is divided in two sides, the left, logical side, where words, logic, and rational thoughts sit, and the right, creative side, which is the imagination and intuition side. Day-to-day circumstances usually are met in a logical left brain mode. However, by yielding to the right, creative side of the brain, we actually restore balance in the brain. This allows access to the mind-body connection to achieve what you want. The right side of the brain automatically steers you to your goal. It totally accepts what you want to accomplish without giving any opinion and acts upon it without any judgment. That is why visualization targets the right, creative side of the brain and not the left, logical side. When I meditate, after a while I turn meditation into visualization and I see myself having won the battle against cancer. Some people visualize their killer cells, the T cells, attacking cancer and gobbling it up bit by bit. And if it works for them, well, that's fine. I don't do that. I just see myself having won and being free of cancer. And then I create all the feelings that I know I will have once my visualization becomes reality. When I end my visualization meditation, I feel re-energized, absolutely great, and on top of the world. But I also feel calm and serene. This combination of being re-energized, being on top of the world, and feeling calm and serene at the same time is a wonderful feeling. I know full well that in this moment my immune system works perfectly well. My organs are strong again. And most importantly, I have made another step in the right direction to win my battle. This is not just a feeling of hope. It is much more than that. It is a firm belief, the knowledge that I'm going to win. With this, I've come to the end of this show, and I thank you very much for listening. Next week, I will continue with the health theme, and I will tell you more about tools that we have at our disposal to improve on our health or to combat illness and disease. Please go to my website, mindmattersonline.info. Mind Matters Online is one word. Find my email address there, and then please write to me. Ask any questions you like. Give me any comments or suggestions. And if you have a problem you want to tell me about, let me know, and I will give you my best possible advice. I always reply to my emails within 48 hours. On my website, you will find also recordings of the last 20 or so of my previous shows, and a link that takes you to the Blog Talk Radio archive, where you find all my shows, old and new. For now, I leave you with words by Lindsay Wagner, and I quote, "A lot of people say that they want to get out of pain, and I'm sure that's true, but they are not willing to make healing a high priority. They are not willing to look inside to see the source of their pain in order to deal with it." Unquote. Tune in again to this show next week. Same day, same time. Goodbye. Welcome to Mind Matters, the show